Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I take what you made, but I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I take what you made, but I got to put you down.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. I'm Patrick Connor of Knuckles and Gloves, The Fight City, Hannibal Boxing, and I'm just popping up all over the place, but that's not even what's important. Today, man, we're talking boxing, like always, and in just a minute, my buddy Bryn Jonathan Butler, not even just a minute, he's here. Bryn, what's up, man?
Not much. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Man, it's an exciting day.
Yes. Just to put our audience in line with what's going on, there's a series by director Mickey Duje, a good friend of mine who I've collaborated with on a number of long-form pieces, directed a series called Losers that explores rather traumatic moments in, I think, 8 different lives, lives that were defined to the public by loss, and sort of explores what happened after and how they found redemption from it. And it's just a really, really special series. And one of the episodes, the first episode that Netflix went with, is about Michael Bent, which I brought to Mickey and worked with him conducting all the interviews with Bent and most of the interviews with the participants in the show. And it's pretty extraordinary. I think the response so far online all day, I've been kind of following it, has been, you know, this is pretty special to sort of celebrate the people who didn't win the big event and to see the value in that as opposed to, you know, this zero-sum game that the American dream so often is. So I can't wait to hear I haven't talked to you yet about what you thought about the show.
I don't want to give too much away either about the show or on my end. I mean, we're going to have to give some away because we're going to be talking about the show, obviously. So it's not like we can't just skip around it for an hour, hour and a half or something like that. But point is, you know, I don't want to give too much away because I want people to watch it. It's definitely worth a watch. It's a very quick watch. It's very engaging. It's entertaining. And I think that above all, and again, just repeating that I don't want to give much away, what I mean by on my end is that, you know, I think that a handful of people might have taken notice, but I've joined the Hannibal Boxing team. Hannibal Boxing is a website, but also they have a publishing arm, and they're putting out a whole bunch of books. And so I'm interviewing a bunch of people who have been writing, who have been involved in making the books, putting them together, et cetera. And in one of the interviews that we have coming up, Donald McCray, the author of Dark Trade, which is, you know, a well-known book in the boxing world, obviously, you know, I interviewed him, and one of the things that we had specifically talked about was kind of like the unheralded type of fighters and telling their story and why it's important to also tell the stories of the unheralded guys and not just focus on the Pacquiao's and the Mayweathers and the Holyfields and Tyson, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And in that sense, I think that's something that this series Losers really does well. Well, obviously, that's what it's about, so it better do it well. But nonetheless, it's a very strong opening with Michael Bent because he's not even the kind of fighter that you would expect to be on there, even though he does embody what the series is talking about. At the same time, he's just not a guy you would have even thought about. He's not somebody you would have thought of. He's maybe somebody you and I would have thought of because we just talked about him on that Tommy Morrison show not too long ago. But still, yeah. Nonetheless, it's surprising. And I thought it was well done. And I didn't even get in the introduction to the part where that's what we were talking about today. And just to repeat, in case anybody's like just tuning in right now, you know, Bryn helped work on this brand new Netflix series, Losers. And the opening episode, the very first episode, you don't have to go very far to find it, is Michael Bent, the former WBO heavyweight champion. It's pretty compelling.
Yeah, and I mean, just to give a little context, is Mickey and I, you know, at the inception of him getting this series, landing it, putting together a number of candidates who sort of fit the ethos of what he wanted to do. Ultimately, somebody fell through, and he came to me in a real jam saying, I need somebody. I need somebody to fill this spot. Who do you think is somebody that sort of has enough value to what we're trying to do, is compelling enough, is surprising enough? A lot of these are really unheard stories by most of the public. It's an array of many different sports. It includes, you know, boxing, curling, the famous figure skater, French figure skater who did a backflip, which was an illegal move, Surya Bonny, I believe her name is. There's an ultra marathon person in the Sahara Desert. These are human stories that happen to be personified by athletes. And I think that's what's really special about this. This is not really a sports show at all. It's just that they happen to be athletes. And in the case of Michael Benn, he was somebody that I was introduced to 2 or 3 years ago, and he just delivered this story of sort of point A to point B. I knew him, I think, the same way you did, Patrick, was knocked out Tommy Morrison, upset Morrison when Morrison was on his way to fighting for millions against Lennox Lewis and millions more against Tyson, and Ben upset that. And then in the following fight, I knew he lost very badly to Herbie Hyde. It turns out he was very close to being beaten to death in the ring. He was literally beaten into a coma because of brain swelling, and the doctors told him he could never come back. And his response to that was to get very lost for a while and ultimately move into the world of acting. He wrote about what it was like to be knocked out. Our favorite friend, Bert Sugar, I guess younger boxing fans probably don't know who that is, but very talented writer.
Oh, man, that's depressing,
writer.
But that's true.
Probably true, isn't it? Maybe I'm off on that.
I don't think you're
Bert
that far
Sugar
off.
Okay, so
we're getting old.
Bert Sugar, a very strange fellow that I had, I guess I would say was fortunate to have met a couple times. Not very nice occasions when I met him, not directed at me, but he was a character. And anyway, he pleaded with Bent to write down what it was like to be knocked down and knocked out in public. And Bent wrote that down into an article called Anatomy for a Knockout. Definitely worth checking out. And it is startlingly intimate, and just a profound consciousness is there laying bare what it's like to experience something that would be a nightmare for anybody to experience. And when Bent experienced it, he knew that his father back at home was watching him fight Herbie Hyde. And when he found out that Bent was knocked into a coma, said they shouldn't wake him up. They should just let him die. And so he always felt like he was more an actor playing a boxer. And so he moved into an actor being an actor and played Sonny Liston in Michael Mann's movie Ali, which I think is an absolutely terrible movie, but Michael Bent is very good in it. And he did all the choreography and helped train Will Smith to look like Ali and to get in shape like Ali. Then Clint Eastwood hired him to do boxing choreography for Million Dollar Baby. He started working on stage, starring as Othello. But this is a very, very unusual fellow, what he's capable of post-boxing. And he's been probably the boxer I've been closest to of all the fighters I've interviewed. He's the one I talk to on the phone from, you know, time to time or regularly. It's a very, very unusual consciousness this guy has. And what's funny, too, is I didn't like him when I was a kid watching him fight. He was one of those fighters I just disliked, and I think probably because he was too self-conscious and it reminded me of myself in some way. I didn't like seeing it, so I thought, good, I hope he loses. I hope Morrison knocks him out or whatever. So, yeah, he's just one of those guys that you connect with and just dislike. But when they win you over, it has an even bigger impact than if you liked him from the beginning.
He's definitely, I think that the element of surprise is important here, and that's something you'd mentioned, something I also mentioned earlier. But you know, if you want to hear the story of I mean, if you want to hear the story of, like, Muhammad Ali, like, you don't need to look far. If you want to hear the story of Floyd Mayweather, you know, you want to hear the story about any number of these really famous fighters, then you don't need to go far. And many of us already know them, or at least large chunks of them. In Ali's case, I mean, a lot of us can, you know, damn near recite them, like, verbatim. But nonetheless, I think, like I said, picking fighters that you wouldn't expect, fighters whose story you might not know, that's important here. And again, not just fighters, these athletes and these people who are relating the human condition through athleticism and through competition. And that's what this series is obviously about, is the human condition as related through this and the perception of wins and losses and what those things are. And, you know, one of the important moments of, well, one of the several important moments in this first episode with Michael Bent is that commentary that, you know, these guys are spending 6-8 week training camps and, you know, busting their asses more or less. And somebody's going to have the audacity to call that person a loser when they just stepped up and put everything on the line. You know, and that's something you and I talk about kind of in a more roundabout way from episode to episode when we talk about fights and stuff like that and just the importance of wins and losses and how things get blown out of proportion and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, that's obviously putting a far, far finer point on it from that gentleman, just saying, you know, it's ridiculous to consider these guys pussies or to consider, you know, something like that. It's pretty stupid. But I think demonstrating that through Michael Bent, who is really eloquent, speaks really well, and is very honest, where I think that we get very used to, in boxing in particular and in combat sports in general, but especially boxing, braggadocio and this facade that's not only expected but in a lot of cases demanded, lest you be different. And by different, I mean, you know, a pussy, a total tulip or something, you know, something like that, or, you know, down that road. And to hear a guy say, look, every time I got into the ring, I fucking hated it. Every time I got into the ring, I wished something would happen so that I didn't have to do it. You know, and then on top of that, when I had success, it felt like the worst thing in the world. I think that that's something that a lot of people, like a lot of everyday, ordinary, normal people can relate to on a very different level, obviously. But hearing somebody who achieved, you know, fairly great heights, as great as the WBO heavyweight title is and was at the time, you know, to hear somebody say that it's important. You know, it's something that the average person perhaps needs to hear.
I think that's absolutely true, and I mean, a couple points about Bent that are really interesting. Bent is one of the most decorated amateur boxers that America ever produced. So this is not some journeyman who had a shitty pedigree and lucked into, you know, where he was as a pro on any level. This was a guy who was a 5-time national champion. He was a bronze medalist at the World Championships, fought Felix Sabone in some really tough fights. And Sabone was maybe the greatest heavyweight juggernaut that Olympic boxing has ever had. And Bent went toe-to-toe with him. So he comes out with a lot of promise. And what happens is he loses his first fight. And everybody says the guy's a complete bust. And Bent has no idea what he's going to do with the rest of his life. Never really wanted to be a boxer. His dad was obsessed with Muhammad Ali. And to your point, Patrick, one of the things that Bent said that just completely floored me, one of many things he said that's floored me since I've been privileged to be friends with him, was the greatest thing that ever happened to me was when I got knocked out by Herbie Hyde and he almost ended my life. Nothing better has ever happened in my existence than that happening, because I could leave this behind and move on to what I really want to do with my life. I don't want to be defined by just being a boxer. I never wanted to be a boxer. There's nothing wrong with it, but I didn't want to be that. And I think that's where we connect to him, and it has nothing to do with sports. I wrote to him right after we had a lunch, the first time I met him. I wrote him just to say, God damn, that was, and I don't do this. I don't send like a thank you letter to meeting somebody, but I wrote him and just said, that was one of the most incredible meetings I've ever had with anybody. I never expected to collide with that consciousness. And he replied immediately, and the first thing he said was, you beat me to the punch, but isn't that the story of my life? And this is a guy who getting beaten to the punch almost ended his life, and he would make a joke about it. That, you know, anybody who would question his courage, that takes more courage than, you know, almost everybody I've ever met put together to offer that as a comic summation of your story, the motif of your life. And this is a guy who came back from being knocked out early, like in his first fight, to win everything after, to get a shot at Tommy Morrison. And the situation that created that was he was a sparring partner for Evander Holyfield. And correct me if I'm wrong, George, who's the great trainer of Holyfield at that time in the early 90s? George
Benton?
Benton? Is that right?
Yeah, Georgie Benton.
Georgie Benton was watching them spar, and Bent was just having a good day, and he was looking good. And Benton came over, and he's somebody who's pretty ungenerous with compliments. Benton said, you know, I was watching you spar with Holyfield today, the heavyweight champion, and frankly, I couldn't tell who the champion was. And that transformed Bent going into Morrison. All of a sudden, it was like, I have a passport, be the person that I had the potential to be in this sport, and I'm going to realize that potential. I don't care what the odds are against Morrison. I can beat anybody. I've gone toe-to-toe with Felix Sabone. I can fight anybody. And he had his moment, you know, a shocking moment where he was almost knocked out in the first round again, but he wasn't out, and he started throwing some punches back, and a number of them landed, and Morrison went down. So this is a guy who's known the extremes of, you know, the highs and lows of winning a heavyweight title in a shocker, a piece of it, and being blown out in a way that very few guys ever walk away from as well. So it's a crazy trajectory as an athlete, and it gets even weirder the moment he moves into acting.
And I do have to say, you mentioned, since you you know, brought up acting, and you mentioned Ali earlier, it was one of those movies where, like, at the time, especially, I say at the time because I was like 18 or something like that when it came out. You know, you're not too much older than me. You're a little bit older than me, but, like, you know, it was at the time I was probably, I would say, just happy that there was a boxing movie in the mainstream more than anything. And so I didn't really care about its quality or whether or not it was good or how good it was. And I was also, like, just delighted that you had James Toney playing Joe Frazier. You had Charles Shufford, who was, like, a total, like, journeyman heavyweight who was, I mean, it's just, you know, it's hardcore shit. Like, only hardcore people would know this shit. And then, you know, I was excited that it was in the mainstream. But, man, that movie was not good. There was nothing, but
was
I will
terrible.
Say this, the boxing choreography was good, Michael Bent.
The boxing choreography was good, and James Toney was amazing. I think James Toney would have been an amazing character actor. He's so charismatic.
Yeah.
And, you know, he embodies the spirit of Joe Frazier that we don't hear enough. My friend Mark Graham Jr. just wrote a biography about Joe Frazier, and Frazier was lending Ali money. Like, in the lead up to how awful Ali was to Frazier and the horrendous impact it had on Frazier's family, goading him with all this racial invective. I mean, the ugly, ugly side of Ali to promote fights did real damage, real, real damage to good people, and not just good people in general, but good people to Ali. And Frazier petitioned to have Ali that shot, petitioned in all kinds of ways to support Ali when most of America was against him, you know, thought he was on the wrong side of Vietnam. And Frazier lent him money because Ali
Mr. Character, Mr. Civil Rights Guy, was aligned with the Nation of Islam that closely lined up with the Ku Klux Klan in terms of their views of a lot of issues in relation to America, never stood up to them, gave all his money away, let himself get it all stolen, let his best friend get murdered with Malcolm X. Frazier stood by him and was rewarded with stuff that, you know, Marvis Frazier talks about it in various documentaries, that Ali never even apologized to Joe Frazier. He apologized to Marvis because he found out about Marvis couldn't even go to school because all his friends said that, you know, your dad's a white, fights for the white man and all this kind of thing. Frazier, who was a sharecropper from the South, from South Carolina, and lived the life that Ali pretended to have lived in some respects in terms of the credibility of working class black people, but he never lived it. He was never raised in it. He was a middle class kid, you know, and very quickly was living quite a comfortable lifestyle. Frazier was a grinder. I mean, Rocky stole everything, all the gravitas from Frazier. Rocky stole it from Frazier's story, including Philadelphia and that whole backstory. It was Frazier running up those steps of the art gallery. That's where Stallone cribbed it all. So I don't know. There's some nice bits in the film, but overall it just doesn't work. Will Smith is just not a convincing Ali. I desperately wanted to be in on it. I like a lot of films from Michael Mann. Heat, The Insider, you know, The Last Mohican. There's some tremendous films there, and I was hoping to see it, but.
Yeah, that Last of the Mohicans is one of my favorite flicks overall. Just really, really, really well done.
Oh yeah, but Ali was just terrible.
Nah, it wasn't good. It's you know, the vast. We've talked about this before, but it's not easy to make a boxing movie, or at least not a. It's not easy to make a boxing movie that's like actually good, and that in any way follows what boxing is, or, you know, is actually even resembling what boxing is. Million Dollar Baby is fucking terrible. I just hated that shit. It was not good. Sorry. I know that, like, is, like, lauded. And, it, dude, I mean, and even Clint Eastwood every so often as a director has his days, but not my thing. Regardless, as far as – oh, and, you know, Michael Bent worked on that as well. The Lucia Riker, she was in that shit. The choreography was fine. You know, this is obviously, these are not needles toward Michael Bent here. The series itself, Losers, I actually kind of wish, and I didn't realize, it's funny, you hit me up this morning, and I hadn't even seen the message yet. And my daughter was eating cereal this morning before school and turned on Netflix so she could watch, like, she was going to watch, I don't even remember what it was. It was like Teen Titans or some shit. And, my account was logged in on Netflix and it was the first thing that popped up and it said something about Michael Bent. And I was like, what? And I looked over and I was kind of just like sitting there watching it going like, what's this? And then maybe probably 5 minutes later, I looked at my phone and I was like, oh, what? You know, I just didn't expect, you know, that you had anything to do with it, and I didn't really know anything about this. And, you know, there have been a handful of boxing-related things that have come out on Netflix that are kind of surprising. There's one on Julio Cesar Chavez that's decent. You know, there's a handful of them that are all right. But regardless, it was pretty cool. And what I actually thought it was at first was I thought it was a series about Michael Bent, and I was like, well, that's – whoa, okay. But, you know, that's obviously not what it is, but – in retrospect, I almost kind of wish, like, I kind of want to hear his story a little bit more. I almost wish it were like two or three episodes about just him and his story, because I think that that arc is, like I said earlier, it's important. It's compelling. It's something that the average person, I think that they can just relate to far more, in the sense that he was an elite athlete. He was obviously competing at a level in boxing that most people don't compete at in anything, whether it's their career or, you know, whatever. So that they cannot really relate to, but they can relate to him as a person, I think, and his fears and how he handled them and in some cases didn't handle them. And anyway, I don't want a broken record myself, but I liked it. I thought it was really good.
No, I mean, it was something – It was very fun. I mean, I didn't mention it to anybody because Mickey really wanted to keep everything under wraps. He's a real perfectionist. He killed himself making this series, and it was a haul. He traveled all over the world for it. I was just with the one episode, just going to L.A. and doing a number of interviews with Ron Shelton, who was the director of White Men Can't Jump, Bull Durham, a number of other films. Who read the article that Bent wrote, Anatomy of a Knockout, and just said, if you can translate any of the emotion that you put on the page here, you're just going to be a hell of a good actor. I've never read anything like this before. And that's what sort of brought him into Hollywood, was Shelton. And Shelton was such an articulate interview. You'll see him in the episode, the way he frames this whole concept of winning and losing and how there's this basic assumption in our country, especially, that it's winners who demonstrate all the character in the world, that it's all their virtue that drives them to succeed. Whereas then I've noticed interviewing people that it's the losers that are the most compelling by far.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I just realized that that's who I was talking about. And that's who I was quoting earlier was Ron Shelton. Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that credit in there because I totally forgot.
Yeah, and just so I think that's the real genius of the show is I've only watched one other of the episodes so far, but they all carry something in them where this is not just that underdogs, that things work out. Sometimes things don't work out. And you have to see how these people reframe their lives and recalibrate their lives to move on. And the way that they've done that and the kind of wisdom that they've acquired through self-reflection is where I think we can all identify with what our goals were early on in our lives and how we have to make some adjustments and how, you know, I don't know that the worst moments in all of our lives translate into becoming the best moments when we look back on them. But a lot of times you can see how some relationship that you had early on that you had a death grip attachment to, that when you finally let go or they let go of you, it really opened you up to something that you never thought was possible that was actually far more beneficial to allowing you to become the person that you most wanted to be. And so there's a very common theme in this that I think is what's so special about it is that Mickey allows these people to speak for themselves to show you this. To show you how they processed these traumatic events on the public stage to varying degrees. And yet it's just so personal. It's so personal and yet it's so universal. I don't know how he was able to do it. You know, it's his talent and it's also just the spectacular characters that he's chosen. But there's real emotion in each one of these. And it's not an emotion that takes away something from you. It doesn't, you know, where you go, oh, fuck, this is so heavy. There are heavy moments, but it brings you to places emotionally that they felt and that maybe that you felt that are very uplifting, that are very inspiring and very human. And Bent, I think, is one of the most articulate voices that Mickey shone a light on about, you know, I never saw this person behind the athlete that I was watching fight when I was a little kid. And when he walked to this table where he was invited to have lunch with me and Thomas Hauser, I was kind of thinking, oh God, this is going to be dreadful. He's going to be a bitter guy because of his career or talk endlessly about Tommy Morrison. I was so, so wrong. And when somebody catches you off guard like that, that you completely misunderstood them, prejudged them, and they surprise you and overwhelm you with what they've acquired along the way. It's just a very transformative experience. And I don't think I'm hyping this at all. I think, you look at the response, go ahead, after you listen to us, if you've not heard of this show, read some of the reviews. They're not up the ass of the show. They're not brown-nosing the show. It's that good. It's that good. And it's very surprising that it's taken this long for somebody to see the value in quote-unquote losers, which sounds like it's a very negative title. like it's sort of shitting on them or mocking them, but it's really mocking the perception of being a loser in the culture and exploring what that means. And I think it's going to make you think a lot more about quote-unquote winners and reassessing what that means in society or in terms of goals, being defined by what you win as opposed to sort of how you play the game or why you're playing the game. And Ben's story just does hit, you know, checks all these boxes that you didn't even know were there.
And you wouldn't know, you know, like it's, you just wouldn't know if it weren't related to you in some other way. I mean, it's, I read shit about people's stories in boxing all the time. I didn't know much about Ben's story apart from what most of us know or what you could ascertain by just looking at his career.
Mm-hmm. No, and as I say, I mean, I think we talked about it before, but one of these things that Jim Lampley told me once that I always turn to is that one of the great things about boxing is there's somebody your size in it. There's somebody big or small or whatever. There's somebody who has a style that you wish that was your style. I think Customato said, you know, how you fight in the ring is how you're going to approach conflict in your life. And boxing does that, right? That's why we're so enthralled by it, by the winners and the losers and whatever, you know, the moments that surprise us in between. And I remember with Bent just feeling so judgmental of his style because I thought he had this bravado of trying to be more confident than he was, and I thought he was going to be exposed. And I look back on it now, and I think there was just this strong identification where I thought if my life had been totally different and I'd been an athlete anywhere close to the level that he was, probably I'd be that guy. I'd be a very unlikable kind of guy in the ring who me as a spectator would cheer against. And yet, you know, you get to know who's behind it. And it's, you know, it's really hard after you watch this show not to really cheer this person on and maybe look at some other people that you've dismissed or judged or have a negative reaction to and reassess why you do, what's going on inside of you that makes you not, you know, go a little deeper, have a little bit of compassion for them. And, you know, it's one of my favorite things with being privileged to interview some of these guys at length and spend time with them and go backstage a little bit is these are all very, very complex people who are fighting on the world stage in any arena of ambition. And there's a lot of demons there and there's a lot of virtue there. And then there's a lot of circumstances and as well that complicates everything. But it's fun to sort of allow these incredible people a platform to talk about things that we don't very often hear. There's nothing glib about anything that this show is trying to do. The glibness is in the title, but the glibness is in reference to how we view winners and losers historically. And I think it could have a real profound impact on our consciousness about that assessment, that very glib assessment we make about winners and losers. And God, I mean, we have a president who's obsessed with the concept of winners and doesn't want you to see what his taxes are, doesn't want you to see what his grades were or his SATs because he's terrified that he won't be able to control the narrative that he's a winner. Everything's about winning, 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 winning. But what's he fighting for? You know, like that question there seems to be no interiority. And Bent is all interiority. And yet he's somebody whose life was spent in action, you know, during his youth. He gave his youth to the sport of action. And, you know, with boxers, these are the only artists where every time they ply their trade, they get damaged a little bit. Even when they win, they get damaged a little bit. So that's where I get really into these stories more than any other sport and why I love our sport, because it's special and it's tragic in that way.
I don't know how much you can divulge or anything like that, but, I mean, mostly, I guess, for my own curiosity, and I'm sure some people listening, as far as Netflix and these other platforms, I mean, this is still on task here, on subject, but it's kind of meandering a little bit. As far as apps and technology and whatnot, DAZN, et cetera, like, you know, boxing's app, it's kind of being thrust into the, you know, evolutionary It's being forced to evolve, I guess I could say. In some ways, it's kind of uncomfortable because it's clear that boxing is just one of those things where it's very traditionalist. There are a lot of people who seem to want to keep it this way or that way or not deviate much from how it has been. And, you know, you can obviously see why that would be the case, because these are the people who stand to lose the most if things were to actually progress and, you know, promoters and managers and whatnot weren't absolutely beating the shit out of fighters financially and taking their money, blah, blah, blah. So there's been a lot of resistance to a lot of this change. And so my question is, with Netflix, DAZN, a lot of these other platforms, it sure seems to me that there's a wide open space, there's an opportunity to potentially seize upon to be able to create these even shorter episodes, shows, you know, movies, short films, whatever the case may be, because there are so many stories in boxing that are worth hearing, and so many that are compelling, I mean, almost by nature. Do you see that happening, and was this show easy enough to work on, produce, put together that, you know, that's a possibility, like doing more of these kinds of things?
I think that shoulder programming in boxing has been stale for a long time. You know, like I think the 24/7 thing originally was brilliant, but I think they found some of the boxers who were the most successful at it to sort of game it, like Mayweather, turned it into something where it felt just like an infomercial. It became one note, and a show like this is anything but one note. I mean, every one of these stories has a similar flavor in that they're recovering from a loss that sort of defined their identity to the public. But the way that they explore that is unique to each of them. And I think that's what boxing is sort of struggling with its characters, is to find genuine things in them that shine the individuality, shine the watermark of these great characters that boxing always has and always will and still does attract. And I think it just somehow turns it into a bit of a sausage factory in how these guys are promoted. And you know, I need to know what they're fighting for, and I don't often, beyond money or fame. Like, it becomes boxing, like a lot of things, just becomes sort of like American Idol in the way that it's promoted. These, you know, I want to be a champ or whatever, which is fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with it, and I don't know why some guys resonate more than others. You know, Andre Ward unpacking all the stuff that he kept so close to his chest about the family life that he grew up with, the addiction, being biracial, feeling like he didn't fit in wherever he went, you know, with the different groups of his family or being out in public. I don't know why his story never worked. I don't know why this Olympic champion who's undefeated and a world champion and is, you know, a good-looking guy and extraordinarily well-spoken and intelligent, nobody seems to care. I don't know. Is that a failure of promotion or what? I don't know. I don't know why the mystery doesn't sell, and I don't know why the disclosure doesn't sell. But I think we see there are other people. I don't know that Arturo Gatti's backstory was super compelling. There's just something about the way he fought that nobody cared who he was fighting next. I think Kathy Duva made that point that he was the only fighter she ever worked with where nobody who was buying tickets ever asked who he was fighting next. Just, when's he fighting? Very, very few people are out there where that's true. You know, we need a nemesis with these people. So I hope that boxing could look at something like this story with Ben, you know, where a lot of the experts that I interviewed, Larry Merchant or talking to Jim Lampley or other people in boxing, were kind of dismissive about him. Just, you know, he had a moment and flash in the pan, he got lucky, but he was sort of a journeyman. I don't think Bent was a journeyman. I don't think you could ever call somebody with his amateur pedigree a journeyman. But he did lose his first fight.
Well, and I think so that... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, please.
Well, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I was just going to say that, you know, I can't speak for everybody, and I think that the vast majority of even boxing fans, one of the first things they're going to do if you ask them about a fighter that they're not particularly, you know, familiar with or don't know a lot of detail about is they're going to go to BoxRec. And like, dude, I'm not talking shit at all. BoxRec's awesome. Those people who work at that site have, you know, that's a labor of love, and it's something that's incredible. But my point is that it's kind of dry. It doesn't really tell you everything. It doesn't really go into detail, and just looking at wins and losses doesn't tell you the whole story. And so you look at his pro record, and it doesn't really look particularly impressive. You start looking for world titles. You find the WBO heavyweight title. You start looking at the time period and realize that that heavyweight title was not particularly respected at that time. So, like, what is it? What exactly does that even mean? But then, you know, that's probably your average even boxing fan. They're going to go look at that and say, yeah, I don't know. I guess he held some sort of belt at some point. Cool. Great. I don't know what that means. But, you know, I did happen to know a little bit more, at least not necessarily at the time, obviously, but later on, that the whole point to the Michael Bent story, to his, you know, narrative, was that he was a massive wasted talent. And I think that the funny thing about that is that I knew more about the story than your average even boxing fan, because I knew the fact that he was a very, very good amateur. But even so, watching this show changed my perception of what I thought I knew. You know, I thought that he was a guy that had been particularly skilled and talented and was built for boxing and blah, blah, blah. But he just kind of, for whatever reason, shat the bed as a pro, which is a very common thing for a lot of, you know, prolific amateurs, even Mark Breland to a degree, you know, very unheralded as a pro compared to his amateur career, because he's one of the greatest American amateurs of all time, if not the greatest, and, you know, if you ask some people. And so my point is that that's what I knew of Michael Bent before, that he was an amateur that just shat the bed. And it turns out that after watching this, that's not really the case. I mean, that kind of is the case, but there's more to it than that. And there's a person behind it. And you can, after watching it, understand. You know, it's not just a guy who, these are the bright lights and, you know, oh shit, a little bit too bright and I'm out. It wasn't like that, you know, and I think that he explains the reasoning for his downfall, for his inability to, or, you know, perhaps, I guess it's lack of desire to really be what he could have, or in some universe should have been, you know.
Yeah, I think that's all true, and I think also it's particularly interesting and bittersweet for me is that after meeting Bent, I've never been more enthusiastic to try to share that story with what I do. And I've interviewed most of the big names in boxing, or many of the big names in boxing, and no editor was remotely interested in his story. They said, well, he's not a famous actor. And he wasn't really a famous boxer. Well, yeah, he had one moment. And then there was a reckoning the following fight. And, you know, he was washed up like his first fight. And are sports fans going to be interested in a quote-unquote loser? Or are they going to be interested in sort of somebody operating at the margins in Hollywood who choreographed a couple of successful boxing movies? Like, why would anybody give a shit about this person? And it's amazing to me. Mickey immediately caught my enthusiasm and just couldn't believe that nobody would want to get involved or get behind his story and to promote it. And Netflix immediately saw the value. And as he said, like your daughter found when she went on Netflix this morning, as millions of people will around the world, in 190 countries, this was on the splash page of Netflix. They were exposed to this guy because these people saw the value of his story. And I like the idea that this puts a little more doubt into the minds of editors that are curators for what people are allowed to read, so that, you know, writers can make a living telling these stories, being a part of these stories to try to bring them out into the world, that there not only is there value in their stories, but they're often so much more interesting than just repeating the same dross about the winners, the household names and the brands that they become in the most boring, pejorative sense of what brand has come to mean in the culture.
Hey, sorry to interrupt you really quick, but quick question. You were the story director? Is that correct? Or story consultant, sorry. Was that what the...
Yeah. I would say I did most of the interviews, and I helped with the transcripts to kind of curate it into shape. But yeah, I operated in a consultant capacity and sort of assisted in bringing the story to the director and to the show and helping in any way that I could to try to get it on. And then once they went for it, I was involved in a lot of the shooting that took place over a week in Los Angeles. And by far, you will see when you watch the series, there's a big celebrity cameo in the form of Mickey Rourke, the weirdest interview I've ever done in my life. I mean, he looks, I don't mean this the way it's going to come off, but
no, it's
my
okay.
God, he looks damn, plastic surgery has left him looking like a 9-year-old woman, you know, the kind of 9-year-old woman I see on the subway quite regularly here in New York City. And even more amazing, Mickey Rourke, one of the greatest actors of his generation for sure, but maybe one of the great actors ever that Hollywood has produced, really only sat down with us to be a part of this project because he wanted to be seen in terms of his value as a professional boxer. He wanted to sort of talk about Michael Bent in relation to boxing as opposed to transitioning into acting and what Michael brought to acting. So that itself was a very surreal moment, was that you could tell that Mickey Rourke viewed himself as sort of like that his career is on par with Hall of Fame fighters, that he's, you know, that he had this extraordinary career that was sort of derailed from his success in Hollywood. So that was kind of amazing. To sit across from Mickey Rourke and he doesn't have a lighter for his cigarette, so I slide my Zippo over and the collagen in his lips was so, there was so much of it that when he was drinking espressos, he didn't have the coordination to keep the coffee in his mouth. It was just unwittingly sort of drooling down. And just because his face is so gone from his control of it now because so much of it has been worked over with surgery. So it was something. I mean, the other interviews that are in there with, you know, the sort of who's who of notable boxing people, Larry Merchant, Freddie Roach, and that sort of thing, that was different. But Mickey Rourke's insight into Michael Bent and the boxing Hollywood thing, because, I mean, so many of these Hollywood types would kill to have the opportunity to get super ripped and play a notable boxer. But a lot of boxers like Michael Bent feel like they're playing boxers themselves, even at the highest level. So it was a very strange intersectionality to have an hour or two with Mickey Rourke. Good God.
I mean, I remember, you know, back in whatever it was, I want to say 2010 or something like that, when Iron Man 2 came out that Mickey Rourke was in. And, I mean, he looked tore up enough in that. You know, that was on the heels of The Wrestler, which was his comeback, you know, his comeback to Hollywood and a very almost, you know, kind of introspective, too much honesty, you know, type of take on himself. But it was something that really did bring him back and got him some pretty instant credibility. But then, you know, anyway, my point, Iron Man 2, even in that, he looked a little tore up, but it was like, all right, you know, we can work with this. It's as soon as, I don't know if that meant that he just delved right back into plastic surgery or what, but as soon as a couple years later, he fought that scrub on some random ass show in, I think, Russia a couple years ago. Ever since
it was
then,
fixed.
It was like the most fixed fight on, like, you know, that side of the fucking Volga. And, dude, this, it was awful. And basically, ever since then, I'm not saying that that was the turning point or anything, but ever since then, the dude has looked like his face is literally melting. I'm not even trying to be funny. It's awful.
No, it's not. It's not funny. It's terrifying. I mean, I was waiting at this little place where he agreed to show up, and the Hollywood, the official vehicle of Hollywood, the like tinted window SUV pulls up, and he gets out, and as I say, it looked like a 90-year-old Jewish woman or like an 80-year-old Jewish woman stepped out. I was like, oh, that's not him. I don't know who that is. Oh no, it is him. Oh my God. And he just walked in and ordered his coffee. And I was like, I wonder if Mickey Rourke still smokes. And he immediately was like, listen, I don't want to be filmed while I'm smoking. I don't want that to be a thing anymore. But just like watching him smoke cigarettes and watching the coffee fall on the table in front of him and like having to move the placemats because they were getting stained from the coffee that was drooling down, and then just listening to a long-winded rant about his boxing career that, you know, that is not, unfortunately, Mickey Rourke doesn't get to define his legacy, you know, where anybody will really take it seriously, and I think he would really wish it to be his boxing career.
It's so strange that, I mean, well, okay, no, I guess it's not that strange, because look, here we are on a podcast talking about things that, you know, perhaps on some level we both wish we would have or could have been able to do ourselves, you know what I'm saying? Like, but, so mm-hmm. I don't want to talk like that and say, like, this guy is some random-ass fool because he thought he was a fighter one time, but it is very Al Bundy-ish, you know, like, fucking Mickey Rourke scored 5 touchdowns in a single game at Polk High once, you know? Because he was a journeyman fighter who was decent and nothing else, and that was it. And I mean, I don't want to put him down or anything like that. It's just that he was not a world-class fighter. And to say, like, you know, it's kind of like he puts on his LinkedIn, like on the very first thing he puts is fighter and then actor. Even though it's like obviously should be reversed. Anyway, I don't want to turn this into a Mickey Rourke bashing session, but I have always gotten the feeling that he would have rather been known for being a fighter, or does kind of have delusions of that he was a great fighter, or that people, you know, knew him as a fighter or something like that, and he really just wants to hold on to that as much as he possibly can.
Yeah, I mean, what we're really talking about is just self-awareness. We're just talking about self-awareness, and that's the thing more than anything that this series highlights, is that a lot of winners out there, and Mickey Rourke was a really, really big winner in Hollywood. You know, he was one of the biggest winners that was produced in the 1980s. He, I mean, if you go through the roles that he turned down, and he was not a success the way he could have been, not because he was fucked in the system, he fucked himself. And listening to him to go on and on about his boxing career, or, you know, a 2-minute lecture about the combinations that he was throwing that were the most effective or whatever. I mean, it was the whole group that was filming him. We were just stunned. And, you know, if Oscar De La Hoya said my boxing career was nothing, really it was my singing career that I should be remembered by. Sorry, but like, you were one of the all-time great boxers. You were not a very good singer. And,
hey, you know what? At least Oscar would have something else to grasp on there, because I'm pretty sure he won a fucking Grammy. I'm just saying, at least in comparison, that would be like Mickey Rourke winning like a lower level title, or, you know, maybe even a, you know, world title or something like that. At least he could point to that, but he did not come anywhere close.
No, and he was even talking about that 6 fight, saying, these motherfuckers say it was a fixed fight, and, you know, as if it was a fixed fight. It was a fixed fight, Mickey. Like, let's move on. So I was like, sorry, but come on. We don't need to. Well, let's leave this alone.
I'm hopefully not going to be, well, whatever, I'll just say it, because what the fuck do I have to worry about? One of Mickey Rourke's opponents was Sean Gibbons. Sean Gibbons is now a matchmaker who works with Top Rank. I don't think he works for Top Rank, but I know he's worked with a number of different fighters. But Sean Gibbons was involved in a pretty big, like, fight-fixing scandal from the Midwest and Oklahoma area a number of years ago, and then been involved in a number of fixed fights himself. So, I mean, you know, it's whatever. It's pretty clear that in the Midwest in the U.S., as far as boxing goes, it's like, it is really like anything goes, man. It's super easy to fix fights. And it's probably some of the dirtiest and most unregulated boxing in the country. I mean, there probably isn't nearly as much now as there used to be, like in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But it's still just, it's to the point where, you know, you probably have like a handful of officials per commission per state, meaning they're just not going to have the ability to oversee a lot of this stuff. And not super coincidentally, this is also where, you know, Tommy Morrison cut his teeth. And this is something we talked about on that Tommy Morrison show a little while back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, it's all true. And, you know, I mean, going back, you referenced the wrestler. I mean, I thought that was one of the great performances probably of that decade. It totally blew me away. I mean, he's such a gifted actor, but there's just so much going on with that guy. And, you know, if there was no Mickey Rourke boxing career, I don't know that we would know Freddie Roach the way we know Freddie Roach. Freddie Roach inherited Wildcard Jim from Mickey Rourke. It was Mickey Rourke's gym originally. And he brought Freddie on board as his trainer. And after he gave up boxing, I think he went back to acting, or maybe there was another hiatus. That's how Freddie Roach got installed in Wildcard originally. That's the genesis story there. So it's so fascinating. Boxing has all these kind of backstories that you meet somebody and sort of learn the backstory, and it connects you to a bunch of other people where you didn't know how they started out, and it really recontextualizes how you see them. One of the reasons why I think Freddie Roach is such a generous person is just that he recognizes how lucky he was. Not that he, you know, to be lucky, you have to be close. He put himself in a position to make stuff happen. After his boxing career was over, when he was only in his mid-20s, you know, he was a teleoperator or something, like doing telemarketing or something like that, before he got involved with Eddie Futch, brought in as a trainer, as an assistant trainer. But it's fascinating. It's such a strange ecosystem. And I never kind of imagined, I was learning about Hollywood in a sort of similar way, how it corresponded, the symmetry there with boxing, in that, you know, here's Ben bringing in Ron Shelton and reaching out to Clint Eastwood to see if Eastwood would be a part of the show. And Michael Mann and some other actors. There's one actor who's in the show who was a co-star in The Matrix and stuff, who Michael had trained for a while. So, you know, and all this is going on while Michael is doing theater in Atlanta. And before that, he was playing Othello on stage. You know, it's crazy. I mean, these are such extraordinary characters, so odd. And I don't know very many of them at all in Hollywood, but I can see why they so identify with boxers. I'd love to know more about sort of Robert De Niro's experience in preparation for playing Jake LaMotta. You know, and obviously, like, Stallone is in the Boxing Hall of Fame. And, like, what's his record on Box Rec? Last time I checked, it's 0-0-0. It doesn't matter. It inspired Vinny Pazienza to become a boxer, and I'm sure a million others, and did a lot of good for the health of the sport. So I think Bent, in a weird way, is a marginalized character in boxing, but his backstory could really make a lot more impact than anybody ever imagined it could, beyond just,
He lost his first fight. He beat Tommy Morrison, was almost killed in his next fight over in England, fighting somebody named Herbie Hyde, who most people have forgotten by now. But there's a lot there, and there was a lot on the way up of things that could have gone very differently, you know, in terms of where he might have landed in the Olympics if this or that fight was scored differently with judges. You know, so it's a fascinating ecosystem. And Bent brought that home to me in a way that I really, really didn't see coming. And I don't think I've been blindsided by a fighter's story anywhere close to as much as Michael Bent in, you know, 9 or 10 years writing about it.
Did anybody reach out to get Bobby Chez on it?
Yeah, Bobby Chez reached out, actually. He called me. It was really scary because, you know, we know that he can't be behind the wheel until 2025, but he was behind the wheel. He's an Uber driver now, and he said he was watching Netflix and Michael Bent's story and wanted to challenge him. He wanted to come out of retirement and get Bent to come out of retirement, and they would fight for the WBO senior citizens diamond title. And, you know, he asked if you and I would be interested in co-promoting it. I said, most likely. I can't speak on behalf of you. You have a new child and everything, but I think we should go for it. And if we decide not to, there's always the availability of hashtag blame Bobby.
I actually spoke with Mauricio Suleiman earlier today about the possibility
really?
Of creating a Poland-Jamaica belt specifically for
Ooh.
That fight if they're able to negotiate it. But that's the big if. I mean, Bobby's got a big ego, man. You get him down at the negotiating table, that dude's like a rhino. You got to be careful.
No, Chappie at the negotiating table is very, very dangerous. And never more so since he's back to being gainfully employed behind the wheel. You know, if I'm ever fortunate enough to be out in New Jersey and to hire him as my driver, as soon as I get into the vehicle, it's a 5-star rating for Bobby Chez. I'm not taking any chances with this guy. He's a dangerous person behind the wheel, and certainly more so with like the looming threat of a 4-star rating.
You're playing him with this motherfucker. Yeah, it's you can't be messing around with Bobby Chez. You got to say, man, all jokes aside here. Seriously, it is funny though because I even saw this loser's business even before I even seen that you had hit me up about it, and so there's no question that there has to be a lot of people, especially in the U.S. who flipped on their Netflix today, this morning, this afternoon, when they got home from work, whatever, and saw that scrolling across their screen. And I got to imagine there's a number of boxing fans who were like, whoa, wait, what? So I hope that's the case, because like I said, I think it's really worthwhile. And I think that it's pretty cool that you got to work on this thing that's, like I'd mentioned earlier, aiding in the evolution of boxing in terms of being available to fans and kind of potentially making new fans. And yeah, man, congratulations. And I think that's really cool.
No, I'm excited about it. Mickey told me just before he mentioned the release date, guess what the first episode's going to be? Because Netflix were the group that decided that. And he said, it's going to be R1. It's going to be Michael Bent. And so I asked if I had permission to contact Michael, and you know, and just a little note in terms of all of us that are out here trying to do things to, you know, try to have a positive impact. I already know, I don't know if I should be saying this, but there was a married couple that had access to watch the series before it was released that go by the name of Barack Obama and Michelle Obama. And after they watched Michael Bent, they watched Michael Bent again. And after they watched it a second time, they watched it a third time because they just couldn't believe it. And they adored it. And that got back to Mickey, and he let me know, and I let Michael know, you know, this quote unquote loser that I couldn't sell a story to save my life, that, you know, two people that meant a lot to him watched it and watched it again and watched it again because they just couldn't get enough of how inspired they were by his story. It's one of the nice things
about this country. I remember Andy Warhol made an observation that one of the great things about America is there's only one Coke. I drink the same Coke as the president. There's just one Coke. Well, it's true with Netflix too, or, you know, media and a lot of these things. There's only one Netflix. There's no presidential or elite Netflix. We all watch the same shit. And so it opens him up to anybody who might stumble upon it, who doesn't even hear it because of a recommendation. And that can go from some of the most powerful people in the world to people that are really struggling to get by. And it can have an impact and can lead to more positive things, genuinely positive things, constructive things that allow us to have a little more compassion for people or compassion for ourselves. And that to me was what I always saw in Michael's story, and is a complete credit to him. And I'm thrilled that trying to badger Mickey into including this story didn't take much, because he just saw it right away, and he put all his heart and soul and intelligence and talent into trying to transmit that esteem that we felt for Michael, because he's a pretty extraordinary guy. And so I encourage anybody who has 45 minutes to invest to give him a chance and give the rest of the shows a chance. It's really special stuff that's done here.
Look, I don't even like other sports, and I'm not even kidding when I say that. Like, I pay attention to boxing. I used to watch American football. I haven't in a number of years. And literally, that's it. I watch boxing. Well, no, that's not true. I do watch combat sports. I watch MMA and occasionally, like, Muay Thai and other combat sports, but primarily boxing. Point is, the first episode was definitely good enough that I'm going to watch the rest, even though I don't really like other sports, because it was done in a way that, like I said, compelling and focusing on subjects that probably aren't the usual subjects and subjects that have a story that means something. So, yeah, good job.
Well, and everybody needs to check out the Surya Bonaly, the French figure skater who met a lot of racism, not a lot of black people represented in figure skating, and it blew me away, this girl's spirit, her tenacity. And you see her at the end, she goes up to a Harlem figure skating group very close to where I live and meets these girls who are there, and they're all people of color, and she tells her story and the impact she has in her charm and eloquence and just directness. Oh, I mean, I watched it this morning just before I went out to teach boxing, and I was in tears. I was so touched by her. So I suspect that they're all going to do this. They're all going to do this to me, and maybe I'm a real soft touch, but I wouldn't be surprised if other people have a similar reaction. There's just something to this stuff that taps into something that gets you very efficiently and deeply. So anyway, thanks for giving me a little platform to shill for this fucking thing.
Nah, man, I think it's worth shilling for. So I think it's definitely worthwhile and worth checking out for anybody who hasn't heard us droning on about it for the last hour or so. And if you haven't already noticed it scrolling across your Netflix as soon as you open up Losers, it's something that came out today. The very first episode features Michael Bent, former WBO heavyweight champion, who was famous for defeating Tommy Morrison in a massive upset. So, you know, that's a very good primer, good to whet the appetite for the rest of the series for a lot of boxing and sports fans. So, in any event, Bryn got to work on this series, and y'all got to check it out. That's it. So, bringing everything to a close, as usual, Bryn, great job again, man, and we'll talk soon, I'm sure. Everybody, if you're on Twitter, do us all a favor, follow Bryn at Brynicio, BRINICIO. If you're following me already, or if you're not, whatever, I can just stumble over my words a little bit here for a moment. If you're on Twitter, follow me at Patrick M. Connor. And if you're on Facebook, like the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page there. And if you're on iTunes, go on to iTunes, leave us a rating, leave us a little comment, blah, blah, blah. Bren, go back to work on more great boxing series, man.
Thanks, man. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you soon.
All right. Take it easy, guys.